You're listening to the Isaka Podcast. I'm your host, Safia Kazi, and today I'm excited to be speaking with Frank Downs and Dustin Brewer. Frank is Senior Director of Cybersecurity Advisory and Assessment Solutions at Isaka, and Dustin is Isaka's Principal Futurist. Our conversation today is in light of the launch of a new Isaka certification, the Certified Data Privacy Solutions Engineer, or CDPSE. And just as a disclaimer, Frank, Dustin, and I are in the United States, so our perspectives and expectations of privacy may differ from others around the world. So Frank, get us started. Why are we talking about privacy today?
So Dustin and I were talking about the CDPSE, right? The CDPSE. And we both received our CDPSEs the other day. For anyone who's listening, we strongly recommend it. It's a really great privacy certification. And as privacy is really like picking up, it's going to be, it already is, very, very applicable. But when we were talking about that, it got us talking about, you know, what is privacy and what do you protect and then what is worth protecting? And then we got real meta kind of because we started to discuss like what is a person online, right? What are the components of you online and what is worth protecting? What is not worth protecting? Which parts of our digital selves are effectively currency? Which parts aren't, right? And then we started to talk about all the different aspects there. And because when you think about it, there's a lot of implications if you want to talk about this digital self, right? So what is your digital self? Because it's kind of evolved over time, which makes sense because the internet's evolved over the time, right? But it was really interesting as you see things progress and get more and more robust. It's grown from small things like, well, like remember when you had just your phone and a PIN and that was for your voicemail and that was for your ATM and stuff like that. I mean, there really wasn't. You had this one combo. It didn't really matter, right? Because there wasn't much to protect. I mean, aside from your money and your voicemails, right? But now you have so many different other elements. I mean, not just biometrics, right? So you have, everyone's always worried about their thumbprints and stuff being stored online, their irises, their genetic makeup, which my wife and I were just having that discussion, right? The other day, I'm like, I really kind of want to know if I've got some illnesses coming and I'm kind of less concerned about seeing a clone of me walk down the street. Because also though, if you see a clone of you walk down the street, one, cool. Right? I mean, if a company's going to make a clone of me, I'm going to be like, wow, neat. I mean, well, that's going to be my first response. Then I'm going to be like, hey, wait a second. Did I agree to this? Which I'm sure there'll be some end user license agreement where they're like, yeah. And I'm like, wait, why did you clone me?
Frank, I know you're excited about this, but no, I don't. I think if you saw a clone of yourself walking down the street, your first reaction would not be, oh, cool.
You don't think so? I'd be like, wow.
I think you'd call 911 immediately.
Well, okay, that's not the immediate response you should use, though, right? Because what if it's a long-lost twin?
It could be a long-lost
twin. Maybe we shouldn't default to clones. Maybe we'd be like, brother.
But if you got your DNA tested, then you'd already know, right?
I hope.
If you had a long-lost twin. Well, maybe you would.
If my long-lost twin also got tested. And okay. We agreed to share it, which, again, comes down to privacy of data and your digital self, right? Because, yeah. You know, whether you want to share that information with anyone else to find out if you have, like, ancestors out there you don't know about. Maybe I don't want to know. Maybe it's an evil twin. Who knows? So I promise this all relates, right? Because there's more aspects of us that are now digital that create this digital self. And I think it's interesting. We're also talking about the fact that it doesn't even matter. We're now seeing organizations and companies and so forth use the lack of information of an individual to build a profile on an individual. One of the better examples I like is when Facebook made profiles of people who didn't make Facebook accounts, right? And they would use those profiles to track. Another example is, I'll use the DNA example again. I believe it was in DC. They were able to close a cold case where there was a killer. It was either a killer or some other miscreant that they had that person's DNA, but they were never able to track them down. Well, they finally were able to find that person because it was their uncle. They were the uncle of someone who got tested. And they said, wait, this genetic profile is really, really close to this cold case. And then they started arresting people, right? So now your digital self is accessible even when you don't make it accessible based upon the inference of it. And so we started talking about, you know, privacy in this context and what should be kept private. What is worth keeping private? How effective is GDPR versus like CCPA and so forth that's coming? And there's a lot of considerations to it. So when we're thinking about this certification, the applicability, it makes you wonder, it makes you consider how things are going to evolve. It really shows the importance of it now. And then just the different components of the person that, you know, as we're moving forward, the privacy is definitely going to have to take a bigger role. What do you think, Dustin?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you kind of hit the nail on the head when you mentioned that, like, we're, you know, this, it's kind of here, right? We this is already happening. This isn't anything.
The goose is cooked.
Yeah, the goose is already cooked. Like, I guess we're just kind of figuring out how you want to, you know, what parts we want to eat. That was a terrible analogy.
That's uncomfortable.
I apologize to the Isaka listening. Yeah, so, but it's here. It's now we're gonna have to deal with. We've created this world, and now we're diving even deeper into it with our digital selves. So, where do we go from here? What parts of it do we want to divvy up? What parts of it are we willing to let be exposed or let be out there on the internet? Now, my wife and I have directly benefited from DNA testing. We recently reunited with her biological father's family. They're wonderful people, and we, you know, we love each other. It could have gone the other way, though, right? We could have met up, you know, and been like, oh, okay, well, you know, it was nice meeting you anyway, so we're going to keep going with our lives. So there's a lot of different aspects and a lot of different ways things can go depending on what you're willing to put out there. I did the 23andMe genetic testing. I did the, you know, genetic marker testing as well to see if I had any, you know, genetic diseases. And thank God I don't. There was like one little one in there that was moderate, but it wasn't that big of a deal. But yeah, that's information's out there. And not only that, but then they also ping me and hit me up for taking other surveys for like sleep patterns and eating habits and all kinds of different things that they're trying to profile now with these humongous data sets that they're getting with people's DNA and their personal answers to surveys, which is amazing. I mean, it's kind of a good way to participate in the scientific community, but then also, yeah, like what are our privacy rights and what's actually being revealed to their, you know, third-party partners and where do we go from here? Frank and I recently also did an internal training for ISOC employees on the dark web. So basically hiding absolutely everything about everything you're doing, right? Except for the fact that you're on the dark web, because your ISP is probably going to know you're on the dark web unless you use a VPN. And then your VPN knows you're on the dark web anyway. So
someone's going to know someone's on the dark web.
Someone's going to know something's going on. That's right. Or someone's on the dark web. And that's the extreme, right? That's like, I want to hide everything. VPN. Using Tor, and if you do that, yes, it is going to hide absolutely everything from as many entities as it possibly can. Not saying that it's a foolproof way to do it, but do we need to go that far every time we sign online? Probably not. What are our acceptable levels of our information being given to third parties? We can, you know, you can sit there and read the 150-page acknowledgement all you want. You still probably won't understand it. I won't understand it. I'm not saying anybody. Unless you're a lawyer or have an advanced degree in law, like you're not going to understand it, right? So what are we willing to put up with? It's definitely a personal choice. Now, with GDPR, with the California Consumer Protection Act, they are trying to distill it and say, okay, at least these, right? At least this. This is the lowest level that we're willing to, you know, accept for privacy. But I don't know, you know, and there are federal lawmakers working on stuff right now as well for U.S. federal privacy laws as well. But we haven't seen anything solidified yet. So it's a big if. It's a big what, I guess. Not an if. It's a big what out there right now as to what we're willing to, I don't want to say sacrifice. That's not exactly the right word, but what we're willing to share with the rest of the world.
Yeah. And so on that note, I mean, just me personally, there's certain companies where it's like, I don't want them having my health information, but then I'll tell Spotify everything about me because it makes amazing playlists for me. So what are some of the factors that you two use when you're deciding what information or how much information you're going to be sharing with, you know, a new product or a new website? What are some of the things you look at when you decide how much you do or don't want to share?
How bad I want the product and how much I don't want to pay.
My question is, how will this make them make a clone of me? It really is a risk reward kind of thing. And I think Dustin hits the nail on the head. How badly do I want to play in this environment, right? How badly do I want to use this tool? The example I'll use is there's no way I'm not going to agree to Google's terms anymore. They just have all my stuff, right? I mean, I could take it down and I could live a life without Google and so forth, and that's fine. They'd still know about me and they've got enough already, right? But for me, it is it comes down to a couple factors. How badly do I need to use this capability? What is the reputation of this organization that I'm going to be working with, right? That I'm going to be giving access. I'm very leery of a lot of those social media companies, not the companies themselves, but the third-party companies inside the social media tools, such as like Facebook and so forth, where they'll use backwards tactics to get you to agree to terms without you knowing they'll agree. What was the one Russian face? They took pictures of your face to age them and so forth. You remember that? That was like 2 years ago. And then you agreed also that they could have a picture of your face and use it for whatever they wanted. That was stressful. And you know what? I'm really glad I wasn't that interested in seeing what I look like when I get old. I figure I'll see it anyway when I get there, hopefully, right? So it was about that. I'd also never heard of the organization or the company, too. So kind of, I'd look for, if I'm boiling down those factors, it's reputation, right? And need of service and obvious capabilities I can see, right? And that's why I always really enjoy working with European Union companies now. Like there was one company I've worked with in the past to help clean resumes up and so forth. And they, I think it was called Nova Resume. In your little profile that you have, there's one big red button at the bottom that just says, delete me, forget me. It said, forget me forever, right? And you could click that and you would be forgotten forever. Wiped, and to the extent that they could, they would wipe everything about that they knew about you off all of their servers. I think that has been super helpful. So, you know, there's also jurisdictional considerations. What about you, Dustin?
Yeah, I agree with everything you said. And, you know, holding, we started with this whole social media revolution. We've also started holding these companies responsible. You know, if there's enough public outcry, they hear it and it hurts them in their wallets, right? Which is where you need to kind of hurt a bigger company in order to get them to, I guess, start the wheels of change would be the best way to put that. But I lost my train of thought.
We're talking about how we have to work with the companies. We actually have, now that these companies are taking advantage, we then use the laws to actually hit them where it hurts in the wallets. And I agree with that.
Yeah.
What's most interesting, I find, is that some of these laws have had caps that they didn't know how to apply, or they realized, okay, the most we can hit Facebook with is a $20 million fine. That's not painful for an organization like Facebook. So then they had to go around and change the law. They literally, you see laws get changed and so forth so that they can make the cap higher so that they can then do something that makes people take notice. Otherwise, it gets to the, what was that old mentality where it's like, it's not a law, it's just a fee for parking here. I can park here. The fee is just the parking fee, right?
Right.
So they had to change, and they had to change the laws and make them okay. When they first put in those, specific laws for don't park and in endangered areas or so forth.
Right. And we call, you know, there's like a new term for it now where like they say that you get shamed, like company shaming or like.
Yeah, company,
you know,
it's like, shaming. I did not see that coming.
We used to just call it boycotting, or we used to just call it, you know, holding a company responsible. But now, of course, we've had to put a negative spin on it because the companies are actually getting hurt. But it is important to hold them, you know, that to hold a company responsible for what's going on. You know, we've seen what happens if you don't, right? This Sarbanes-Oxley has come about because of that, right? We had WorldCom and we had Enron. And I mean, it was just, that's what happens when you don't, you know, when you don't hold somebody responsible or hold a company responsible for maybe not doing something illegal, but definitely not doing something ethical, I guess would be the point. So that's a big thing, is looking at a company's ethics. And you see Google and Apple and Facebook get pinged on this all the time. And I think it's almost like an ecosystem of, you know, that it kind of does keep that company in check. We're like, yeah, you're not necessarily doing anything illegal, but you are selling my private information to a third party who then is using it to manipulate something, right? Something in the world, or manipulate me, or manipulate somebody else based off of the type of person that I am. I think a big part of it for me too is seeing that those companies are getting pinged, like seeing, oh, yep, they got in trouble. And then seeing that they change, of course, right? Saying, oh yeah, sorry, we made a mistake. We're going to change our policy here and we're going to continue doing what we do. And I think that's great.
And I like that you brought up that, you know, line between ethics and legality there, right? Because you saw the initial response with people realizing. So Dustin and I, with our career and our background, with what we've done, we've kind of, it was a way of life, right? Knowing, okay, yeah, Facebook, they're selling your stuff and so forth. And it was kind of, well, I'd say, man, from 2008, 2009, all the way through, I'd say to 2015, right? We were just like, yeah, I guess this is just how it is. No one seems to care. Everybody seems fine with this. And as you saw what people, because what was interesting was that a lot of these companies, in certain instances, with some of these big scandals that you've seen, Cambridge Analytica, right? That what Facebook did and what was enabled there wasn't technically illegal.
Not at all.
Right? It just made everybody real put off. But it was a natural progression of what was going to happen for years. Just in this instance, it became much more political and so forth. And people, it started to get greater attention due to the impact that people believed it to have, right? So it's interesting to watch this progression from, I'd say, ethical into legal, right? Because now you're seeing some of the laws change, and that's, you know, we have GDPR now, right? We have the California CCPR. You have everything coming online, right? That is then saying, okay, we kind of took this to the farthest extent. Man, even Westworld's most recent season was based off this, right? What do you do when you have so much data with about all these people? Well, can you control the people and so forth? Spoiler alerts, sorry. I thought I'd never have to say that on this podcast. So it's, you're seeing this development. It's why we need things such as CDPSI as a certification. It's why we need things that can then, and even if, and it's not just people also, by the way, it's been a huge concern for companies and should be a huge concern for companies too. What's your digital footprint look like, right? What's your company's digital profile look like? What's your risk profile look like? Thankfully, we have something for that too, with the risk profiles there for that can be measured and then tamed and then targeted on the CMMI cyber maturity platform. Because with using that, you're able to then take stock of what your digital, what your whole cyber footprint looks like. And hey, we left a bunch of ports open. That's not good. Same thing with, you know, individuals. Oh, man, I haven't changed my password since 2014. And that's a joke on you for everyone who's listening, because I certainly have. Or have I? Right? Yeah, I think it's an important discussion that we're having. We're watching a lot of things change. And as we're changing, I at least know that I'm glad ISOC is changing also to keep pace and provide these kinds of things for individuals and professionals to leverage, so that they can, you know, take this privacy situation and this digital life, right, this digital profile head on, the challenges that come with it.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting that you mentioned change, because especially in light of the pandemic, you know, a lot of consumers' expectations of privacy are a little bit different now. And, you know, if a company's going to do something that can maybe help stop the spread of the pandemic, they want to know. But how do we address the fact that maybe things change based on the circumstance, and we may have, you know, less privacy now, and we need to change that in the future? And how can we go back to being more private when we've eased privacy restrictions?
I'll let the futurists answer that first.
There is no going back. No, but yeah, that is a big concern for people right now as well, right? You know, where do we draw the line? Because at some point, if, for example, everybody in China didn't have any privacy in Wuhan, and that data was available to everybody all the time, we would have been able to catch this pandemic before it, you know, came to a serious fruition, which it has, right? But the point is that I see a lot of people like, oh, well, now the government's going to have a reason to monitor our health and to monitor this for pandemic breakouts. And it's like, okay, maybe, but it didn't work in China, right? And it probably wouldn't work again, because people, you'll still need to be notified of your privacies being infringed upon, right? I guess, or of your willingness to give away private data for the good of the country or for the good of humanity or whatever it is you want to think of it as. I do see maybe a play for it, but I don't see it actually taking hold, because I think we had a good enough foothold into stopping the collection and the selling of our private data already before the pandemic started. And I think that kind of got the ball rolling. If this were our first introduction to such a thing, then yeah, we might be in a little bit of trouble here when it comes to our privacy. I don't see it. We have a couple of pieces of legislation already. We're working on a federal one in the United States. The European Union did a great job with theirs. So there are already fail safes there for that. Frank, what do you think?
I agree with Dustin. There's no going back, right? It's not like, what was it, that show Lost, when they're like, we need to go back. So you can't. At least the consumer, the individual, the person is not going to go back, right? Unless there's some legitimate legislation that is placed on other countries and so forth, or that other countries developed. Yeah, there's no going back to what there was. For example, I have no desire ever to get rid of my Echoes. I have an Echo in nearly every room of my house, right? And I want to have that. And I'm willing to give, you know, go ahead, listen, I hope they're enjoying this podcast as they record it, right? Thanks, Amazon, for the backup. But like, I think that it's going to have to be a legislative action that is then put out there to benefit the people, because the people, I mean, I'm certainly not getting rid of my smart light bulbs. That's just how it is, right? The people have become so comfortable with it. So I think that's going to be the big consideration there when you consider something like what we're discussing.
Right. And now you also see the younger generations who are coming up, and they're getting iPhones at the age of like 14, right? And they're borrowing each other's iPhones and putting each other's biometric information into each other's iPhones. And
my son's on an iPad right now.
Yeah. And to, but to them, it's like, it's a way of life, right? It's like, oh, nope, this is the new, for them, it's the new, it's going to be the new norm. Frank and I are going to be sitting there old men someday in a retirement home, I guess together. I don't know, Frank, I guess we'll live in the same
place. Depends on what my genetic printout sends me back when I send my DNA.
So Frank and I'll be sitting there, and then like, we're going to be the, they're going to be like, oh, grandpa, you're so paranoid. And you know, our grandkids are going to be saying that kind of stuff, because for them, it's going to be like, nope, this is the new norm. This is the new way of life. I think with these different pieces of legislation, with these different certifications that we have, with these different ideas of ethics and privacy coming together, we are attempting to mitigate that a bit, right? To make sure that it's like not too much of our grandkids' privacies or our children's privacies are going to be infringed, what we would consider infringed upon, but enough so that we don't hinder scientific research and early warning systems and all that stuff that you actually can all the good that can come from big data.
All right, cool. Is there anything else you'd like to add before we wrap up?
The big thing I would say with this is it's good that privacy is getting more notice. It's encouraging that it's going to be picked up more. Hopefully Dustin and I can avoid, at least to some extent, the future where, you know, just everything's already sold. And you guys too, all our listeners, you guys are invited to that happy future also.
It sounds like a happy future, I think, I guess. And not only, you know, it's been something that's been on the mind of a lot of people for a long time. We've seen protests, we've heard different opinions on where privacy needs to go and how we need to, you know, keep privacy and how much is too much information. At the same time, and this is, of course, going back to my last remark, this is the futurist in me that's saying, we also don't want to hinder the capabilities that sharing information can have, right? Not a whole lot of people, there's not a lot of people right now who are really excited or would even accept the idea of an open society of actually, you know, sharing all the information for the betterment of society. It's a fine line, right? It's a fine line between infringement and scientific discovery and great innovations in technology. But that's what we have to do here, right? We're almost, I feel like the tech industry is finally being, at least the internet is finally being taken serious by some lawmakers and like, oh, wow, this is like its own world. Now we have to govern that as well. They've been doing it for a while as far as making money and taxing it. But now we're actually seeing them like, oh, okay, this is like a whole nother world. And now we have to like start moving some legislation, some protections into this new world from our old world to mitigate some of these issues that we're seeing.
Thanks, Frank and Dustin. And that's all we have time for in this episode of the podcast. But if you're interested in hearing more from Frank and Dustin every month, be sure to subscribe to the Isoca podcast.